accession number 20271, Reel 2.
Ron Hill, Reel 2.
And then after the thing, you hear, carriage, return, zhunk. And if you've got a class of about 40, all learning the touch typing, you can imagine the crash of the carriage returns. It was all over the signal school. You know what I mean? Yeah, superb.
What did you and the rest of the crew in Mauritius do in relation to the crisis in Palestine?
The thing for the Mauritius, it was the big cruiser in charge, and there were two big liners called the Pan York and the Pan Crescent, and they'd come from the Balkans with an American crew. And I'm the boy tell on watch, and one of the commanders was Israeli speaking. And they fitted me out with what they call a wire recorder. Now you call them tape recorders, but this was done on wire. And I was told to listen between two certain frequencies. And if I heard strange tones or strange language and they were loud, I had to record it. Because we were searching. We knew they'd come down from the Balkans. And I think there was something like 12 or 15,000 ton liners. And when they went to bed that night in the Med, coming down to try and get onto into what was then Palestine. And they went to bed that night with not a thing on the horizon. And the next morning there was a dirty big cruiser and about 7, 8 or 9 destroyers surrounding them. During the night, I'd heard these two talking, but I didn't know who they were because they were talking Israeli. And they'd given the position for the rendezvous in the morning. So, of course, every morning at 7 o'clock, the commander came up, took the tape away, and the next thing we know, of course, we were away. When you boarded both ships via boarding nets, they were throwing potatoes filled with razor blades at you. And one of our able seamen was killed by a knitting needle on a little ship called the Peppino. And the chap scuttled it. When we took it into Haifa, it made a run for the shore. And somebody opened up the seacocks. And they were all trying to swim ashore. And on the jetty, now I'm going back years now, I think there were the Green Howards. And the next thing, they were opening up on the people in the water with machine guns. And the pipe came over on the upper deck. Anybody below the age of 18, off the upper deck. So we had to get off the upper deck so that you wouldn't witness what was going on.
Why did they open fire?
They were all trying to get ashore, thousands of them. And of course, we'd already reported one able seaman killed. And of course, they didn't say, whoever it was, didn't take any chance, I suppose. Because a lot of them, when I say Green Howards, a lot of them was what they call Palestine police, which were ex-army from the end of the war. And then what we did, when the liners came in, we took all these people off the liner onto our quarterdeck, and we deloused them. And I've got photographs upstairs, and it's the most, how can I put it, degrading sight to see a woman there. You had women beautifully dressed with fur coats and diamonds and pearls, and alongside you saw scruffy little scruffians, you know, and women with two kids that were so poor. You understand what I mean? The difference was amazing in the two of them. And then what they used to do, this is the degrading part, they used to delouse them. Because when you went to windward of the ships, the smell, you can imagine, all these people with about, say, toilets for about 20 on board. You know what I mean? The smell, they probably never had enough water for a bath. And then they were taken across our ship, the Mauritius, after being deloused, and we had a tanker alongside, great big tanker, and they were put in the holds of the tankers. and taken to Cyprus.
How was the shipmate killed with a knitting needle?
He was going... I'd never seen the Israeli flag before. And it was a big silk flag flying from the forward mast, the foremast. And this young lad was told to go up and take the flag down. And it was like rigging. And as he was trying to start the rigging to get the flag, this woman, little needle, was killed before he hit the deck. Anyway, all hell broke loose. I'll give you an example. I remember, I'm only, what then, 17, 1947, I'm 17. I'm in the boarding party with me radio on me back. Right, and I've got a great big tin helmet that's far too big for me. And it looked like the American tin helmets. You know what I mean? Like the paratroops tin helmets, going back years. And when I got up top, I was sent to the wireless office with this lieutenant. Now, I know nothing about guns in them days. Okay? He gets in the wireless office, and there's a big fat chap in the corner with a dirty white vest on. American. And this officer takes his revolver, you know, it's on a lanyard around the officer's neck. He hands this revolver to me and it says, if he moves, shoot him. Now, I'm 17. Now, you don't realise how heavy a revolver is until you're holding it for about 15 minutes. And it's so heavy, I put my other hand up. Now, remember, I've got my radio on me back as well, with the aerial. And this guy's... the gun's doing this because it's so heavy. Yeah. And this guy says to me, now, watch what you're doing, son. Watch what you're doing. You know, I was terrified, to be honest with you. And then all of a sudden the lieutenant came in. Thank you very much. And that's absolutely true. I was a boy telegraphist, boarding party. And this is how we know they were throwing the potatoes down at us. Because when you looked in the bottom of the boat, there was razor blades stuck in them.
And where was this?
When we were boarding the Pan York or the Pan Crescent, one of those two liners.
Off the coast of Palestine?
Well, you say off the coast, it was more, there were more than 20 miles out, I would think. And I think what they did is just ran for the shore. You know what I mean? When they got within sight, full ahead, run for the shore, beat it. But the little Peppino was caught, and it had about, no, I'm guessing now, I reckon about 60 or 70 people on board. And this is where this guy was stabbed with this needle. It was escorted in by one of the destroyers, Childers or the Checkers or Chieftain or something like that. And as it came into the harbour, he made a run for the shore. But at the same time, somebody opened the seacocks, you know, so that it was sinking as it was running. And that's where the guy got killed, the able seaman, off the Mauritius, going up for the flag. In the finish, they cut the flag down before it had a chance to sink. But that's the first time I've ever seen the Israeli flag. Even today, it's the same flag with the double triangle type thing. And it was silk, white and blue.
And did you know the shipmate who was killed?
No. Or even able seaman. Now remember, as a telegraphist, you had very little to do with other people in the ship, because it's a big ship. You know, people say to me, do you remember Stoker so-and-so? We didn't know any Stokers. You were in your own little world. You did your own job. You went up to the wireless office. You came down again. You had very little to do with anybody else. You had your own mates. It's like a little world of your own, if you like.
And where was the incident where you were told to get off the bridge so you wouldn't witness this thing?
It was in Haifa Harbour. Because the Peppino was rushing for the shore. And that's how we found out about it. That's how the AB was killed. And then all of a sudden we heard the firing. You couldn't see very much. You just heard it, and the pipe came, everybody under the age of 18 off the upper deck.
Were they aiming at the people in the water, or just
frightened? I would think so. No, I think they were aiming at them.
How long did the firing last for?
Couldn't tell you. We had to get off the upper deck. We had to get down below. It was in the afternoon, I think. It was after lunch.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, how you got wounded in Palestine. Can you repeat that?
Yes. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm the boy teller, the boy telegraphist of the watch, and the signals come in on the typewriter. So the killick of the watch, and it's funny, you know, I remember the killick's name, Bob Hughes, because his initials were the same as mine, RH. He was the killick of the watch. And he detailed me off to collect, because I've taken all the signals down, and they're all in big pack alongside. And at the end of the gangway, outside the Bridge Wireless office, you had to walk down the gangway to get to the main signal office. You know what I mean? Which was like the other end of your office, if that makes sense. You're at one end of the passageway or the gangway, and it's an open bridge. You know what I mean? Where you are, it's an open gangway. And I'd already told you about my trousers and my shirt, which had hung over. Of course, 2 o'clock in the morning.
This is your washing.
Oh, that's washing, yeah. It wasn't the only one. There was two or three of them there. But this particular night, I was the only one because it was the middle watch. The middle watch is midnight till four. And this was about 2 o'clock in the morning. So I collected up the signals, went out the door. Now, you go through two doors to get out the main wireless office. And when you go through one door, you get safety switches which stops the light going out. But these safety switches for the outer door had been broken. They'd been reported, but they hadn't been fixed. So as I went out of the door, the light comes from behind me from the office and shines down, if you like, the passageway, the open passageway. And they reckon that he fired at my shadow. This is what I was saying. The bullet hit the 4-inch armour plate. Now, you would have thought the bullet would have just gone boom and down. You would have seen the dint in the armour plate, which I didn't see for another 4 or 5 days. There's a big dint in this armour plate, and the bullet shattered. And a little piece of the bullet hit me.
In the forehead.
In the forehead. I didn't know anything, didn't feel anything. They heard the crash, come running out, and of course, there's blood everywhere. And they thought I was dead. And, of course, big panic, 2 o'clock in the morning, trying to get people up from the sick bay, because the sick bay is way down. Anyway, I woke up 2 days later in the sick bay and swathed in bandages. And apparently, when they wiped everything, I just had a little cut there. But that cut was enough to concuss me. So you can't say I was hit by a bullet. It was just a piece of the bullet.
And this was Haifa?
It was in Haifa Harbour, yeah. There used to be, at the top, there was a hill in Haifa, in the centre. And there used to be a searchlight used to go around, regular as clockwork. And when it got to a certain sector, the sniper would have a go. And regular as clockwork, the light would go out. And in the finish, they had it such a fine art, about 2 minutes later, it would come on again, and away it would go again. And they used to, I don't know whether it was a game they were playing, but whoever the sniper was used to aim at this light. You know, like a halogen light today, but it was like a big 20-inch searchlight, and it used to sweep from the hill in Haifa. Very good.
Which year was this when you were...
1947.
And were these other incidents you've described in 47 as well?
About them.
Any other incidents in relation to the Palestine crisis that happened to you?
Well, no, because we weren't allowed ashore in Palestine.
Were there any other incidents in relation to the illegal immigrants?
No, I remember taking the photographs of the delousing process, very degrading. That was everybody. You had to walk, and it was like great big, like gas cylinders, and it was white powder, and they used to just stuff them. Just lift their arms up and stuff it under their dresses and lift their dresses up and stuff it under their, you know, most degrading thing you ever met. To me, as a young lad, because you'd never seen anything like this before, you know.
Did you have to do it yourself?
No. They were all much older than us. I would imagine they were well-trained. You know what I mean? They could have been sick bay. I don't think they were sick bay because some of them were able seamen. Or killick seamen. They were just a team, you know, trained by the dock to do those things.
What did you and your shipmates think about the illegal immigrants?
We did a job. A lot of people say to me, what you've got to think of is this. Being in the Navy, you're non-political. You've got to be, because no matter which government's in power, you do as you're told. Even a skipper does as he's told. And I have a great affinity to Her Majesty the Queen, or as it was then, King George VI. He was our king. So your affinity was to the king, if you like. It didn't matter what power. I always remember in 1948, they gave us a pay rise. I think the Labour Party came into power. Bear with this now, I'm going back a few years. I think Winston Churchill was defeated, and in 1948, our pay doubled. It literally doubled. In 1950, we went out to Hong Kong, and we used to get £2.50 a fortnight. That was our rate of pay. So one rate, but mind you, things were much cheaper in them days. And I think in one week it went from £2.50 or £2.10 as it was then to a fiver. We thought this was magic. The pay doubled, literally doubled. Yeah, I think it was when. I don't know. I think it was when Labour came into power. Whether there'd been, remember, an awful lot of people then were leaving the services from the end of the war. And I was on a train. We went down to go out to Mauritius, to go out to the ship to join the Mauritius. They put the four of us onto a train going down to Southampton. When you got to Southampton, all the carriages were locked. And they opened each carriage in turn, and you walked between two lines of military police to the gangway of a ship called the Dunottar Castle, one of the castle lines. And it took us, and people were waiting to come home to be discharged. And yet they were sending all these others who'd been in during the war, they were sending them out. I couldn't understand that. And we got, all of a sudden, our pay went to £1 a month. It used to be half a crown. That's what you got paid, half a crown a week. When you were over a certain age, after so many 12 weeks in training, it went to 2 and 6 from 2 shillings. You know what I mean? 10p. And then you had to walk, or march, to the naffy, and you used to get a 1 and 6 penny naffy bag. And in this 1 and 6, it was compulsory. And in this 1 and 6 penny naffy bag was enough little weeny tins of boot black to do your shoes, little weeny tins of toothpaste, a bar of soap. You had to pay for your teapot. You know, it was 6 pence, but you never got that. That was issued to you later when you went to do your washing. And you had 6 pence left, and you used to have a big mess meeting. What are you going to spend the 6 pence on? That's true. And when you put your hat, you have to take your hat off, put it on the table, and he puts a 2 shilling piece in the middle of your hat.
Why?
That was your pay.
Why in the middle of your hat?
Well, you had to take your hat off, you see, put it down. And then he put your two, and then as soon as you picked it up, you ran outside at the double, and you all fell in into three lines, and you were marched to the naffy for your 1 and 6 penny naffy bags. And on a Sunday, I'm talking about the Isle of Man now, coming down the hill, you're only allowed ashore on Sunday, and it was from 11 o'clock to about 3. And as you walked down the hill from Cunningham's Holiday Camp, there was a cake shop, and it used to open on a Sunday morning till about 2 o'clock. And we used to ogle the cakes in the window, because you never saw cakes. You understand what I mean? You never saw chocolate cakes in. And we used to ogle, remember, we were only 15 and a half. And we had our nose pressed to the window. And the little girls behind the, you know, the servers used to look at these little sailors. When they shut at, I think it was 1 or 2 o'clock, what cakes were open, were over. They used to queue up outside. They used to give you 2 cakes each to go. And we used to eat them before we went back. That gives you some idea. A little cake shop halfway down the hill. Yeah.
Were there any other crises in the Mediterranean when you were serving in Mauritius that you attended?
No. No. I came home from there, and I got a draft ship to join HMS Dolphin. HMS Dolphin, as you may or may not know, by that time, I qualified for telegraphist. When I left the ship, I was an ordinary telegraphist, and I went up to Mercury in 1948, and I was qualified as a telegraphist. And I got a draft ship to join HMS Dolphin. Now, Dolphin is the submarine base, and I didn't want submarines. I did not like submarines. So I went down there, and I said, I don't want Dolphin. You're not submarines, you're base staff, the lying bloody Toregs. So I was happy with that. I thought, okay, base staff. See, so I remember, I'm only 5 foot nothing with my kit bag and my hammock. And the little truck takes me down to Pompey, because you're up in East Meon in Petersfield. And you get on this little boat, and it takes you across, and it drops you off at HMS Dolphin, you see. Next thing you know, I'm going up and down a big tank with nose things on my nose. And I says, hang on, I says, I'm based up. Everybody's got to do this, lying tow rags. Anyway, I did about 3 weeks of this, all these tests, and I went to sea for my sea training in a submarine called HMS Totem. And I says, I'm based up. Everybody's got to do this. Anyway, after 6 weeks, somebody said to me, boss wants to see you. So I went to see his lieutenant commander. And he said to me, you don't like submarines, do you, Hill? I said, no, sir, because I'd moaned and groaned the whole time. 6 weeks I was there. And he sent me 200 yards down the road to another base called HMS Hornet. HMS Hornet was motor torpedo boats. And to this day, I never knew which was worse. Because with a motor torpedo boat, when you hit a little wave at speed, it's like hitting a brick wall. Whereas with a submarine, if you had a drop of ruffers, if you like, you pressed a button and it look, and it was nice and calm. Mind you, I hated every minute in subs. My first draft ship, when I joined Hornet, the motor torpedo boat I was to join, only a small one, it wasn't the big dog boat, was on the stocks. And after about 2 or 3 days, there was nothing I could do as the telegraphist. So in the finish, we were sent for a lieutenant commander, a rate that you don't see in the Navy today, called a Mickey Mouse man. A motor mechanic. You don't see him today. You don't hear of him today. Because your engines on your MTBs were the great big... It used high-octane fuel. It used the aero engines. So they called them motor mechanics. You know, they were nothing like the steam turbines, I think. And they flew, there was 8 of us all together, and they flew us to Marseille. When we gets to Marseille, we picked up a French-built E-boat, brand spanking new, made of wood. When I went down the wireless office, everything was all sealed. Couldn't use the radio. All German. You know, all sealed up. So my job was the oldest lamp, Lieutenant's oldest. And then it was, I would say it was coming up to winter, because it was bloody cold. When we picked up the sea boat, I don't know whether we'd never heard of, and I'd never heard of, up to that time, a thing called a turbo diesel. And even today, you see the odd car, turbo diesel. Now, remember, I'm talking 1948, okay? When you join that E-boat, and we brought that E-boat home, not a single order could be given because you couldn't hear anything. Everything was done in mime. And when you left the ship, when we got it back, this E-boat, they put you into your little Nissen huts in Hornet for at least 4 hours just to get your hearing back. Because the noise from these diesels. Now, what we did then, the reason why we brought it back, from between the Isle of Wight and Portsmouth was a measured mile. And they put us at the start of the measured mile with 4 motor torpedo boats. And then when the very pistol was pulled, the ordinary British MTBs just put the thing in gear, the boom went down, and they went like the clappers. This German E-boat went chug, 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 chug. 48.8 knots when we went past the first ones before we got to the end of the measured mile. That's the fastest I've ever been in any ship anywhere in the world. 48.8 knots on that E-boat. That's absolutely true. What they did in the war, apparently, remember, it wasn't in the war. What they did in the war, they offered a prize of £500 to any ship that could bring an E-boat ashore. And all through the war, not one. They even tried towing them in that were sinking. And not a single E-boat was caught. And remember, they were made of wood. Now, at the end of my time there, I joined what they call the experimental squadron, and they built two motor torpedo boats, one made of aluminium and the other one made of plywood. Now this was in, when would it be, end of 1948. The plywood boat eventually all the plywood warped. The aluminium boat, both of these had a brand new radio on board called a 612. And what we did, these 612s, they were supposed to be portables, but they were so heavy, they had to build a cart to put them on. You know, and you'd run them around. We slung them in a net between two MTBs, and I keyed that radio all the way across to a place in France called Paimpol, P-A-I-M-P-O-L. When we got to Paimpol, the two MTBs were invited to a game of football by the local football team. I think they walloped us about 27-0, because I didn't play football. I was an outside right, but no way. They were proper footballers, and we got walloped 27-0. Because we had to make one team out of two MTBs. Now remember, on an MTB, this is another story now, when you first join an MTB, there's no cooks on a motor torpedo boat. You don't have cooks on an MTB, but you've got 10 in the crew. So my first order was, go down to the galley and spend a week in the galley watching them what they're doing. You had 9 weeks of this. On the 10th week, you were the chef. And to this day, I still can't make clacker. What is clacker? Crusty pastry. I used to make it so hard that I used to make stacks of gravy to pour over the pastry. And even to this day, I still can't make pastry. But my wife doesn't like me playing around in the kitchen because I like playing. You know, probably put it down to them. I'll tell you another thing I did. You had little weenie radios, civilian type, in the MTB mess deck of the lads. I mean, you couldn't get very much good reception, and you weren't allowed to tap into the ship's aerials. So I thought of an idea. I opened up the scuttle, and I threw the aerial in the water. Do you know it's the greatest aerial in the world? You put an aerial to a radio. Talking about a receiver now, not talking about a transmitter. Only a receiver. You throw it over the side. And we used to receive a program called Radio Luxembourg. And we were the only MTB in that fleet that could get Radio Luxembourg from 7 o'clock. Used to get it from 9 o'clock. Because the ionized layers used to go up and come down at night time. But we were the only ones that could get it loud and clear at 7 o'clock at night. She used to come on board. Nobody would tell them. I said, don't tell them. You used to sling it out the scuttle into the water and just slowly, you know, so nobody could see it. And it was the finest aerial in the world. Never forgotten that.
And so this experimental squadron was at HMS
Hornet? At HMS Hornet. There was only the two, and both were failures. because the aluminium, even when he